listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa has made a remarkable journey to the most advanced operating rooms in this country from his early farm days in California, where he once earned $3.35 an hour cultivating tomatoes and chili peppers in the San Joaquin Valley. What makes his journey unique, writes journalist Jorge Ramos, is that the same hands that picked vegetables are now touching the brains of his patients and saving lives. He did in just one life what usually takes two or three generations. Dr. Quiñones Hinojosa received his medical degree from Harvard University, where he graduated cum laude. He completed his residency in neurosurgery at UC San Francisco, where he also completed a postdoc fellowship in developmental and stem cell biology. At Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, he is an associate professor of neurosurgery and oncology, neuroscience, and cellular and molecular medicine. And in addition to directing the brain tumor surgery program at Johns Hopkins Bayview Hospital and the pituitary surgery program at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, he leads the brain tumor stem cell laboratory, where he focuses on the surgical treatment of primary and metastatic brain tumors. He arrived in Los Angeles on his 19th birthday, and he knew no one. He spent his last dollar and a half on a cheeseburger at LAX, then scrounged for leftovers in the food court. So now when we see invisible, undocumented immigrants, we should think of Dr. Q and think that that person might be a life-saving brain surgeon, or a lawyer, or a writer, or a teacher. In his gripping memoir, Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa tells his life story from his impoverished childhood in the tiny village of Palaco, Mexico, where his family lived in two rooms behind his father's gas station, to his harrowing border crossing and his transformation from illegal immigrant to American citizen and gifted student at UC Berkeley and Harvard Medical School. We are very, very pleased to have in conversation with Dr. Q tonight, Adolfo Guzman Lopez, who many of you know. He's been a reporter with Southern California Public Radio, KPCC, since 2000. He reports on education, politics, culture, and an occasional fire, and his work has been recognized with many awards. He last moderated a panel for us on Ciudad Juarez, and before that on the Brave Journalists of Tijuana. And he's also a fine poet. And he writes the Movimiento blog every week for KCET.org. You can read him there. Please enjoy this conversation. Please welcome our guests, Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa and Adolfo Guzman Lopez, to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you so much.
Well, before we start our conversation, I wanted to bring somebody out, not so much to bless the conversation, but to maybe look over it and oversee the conversation. I had to go to my favorite Spanish language newsstand on First and Soto in Royal Heights. So Calimán will be here, and you'll find out a little bit later what this is all about. Can I call you Dr. Q?
Of course.
I have a little problem with three names.
Yes.
A little bit of a problem.
We both have the same problem.
So you'll talk about Calimán a little bit later. Comic book hero. I think you and I are probably one of the last generations of people who grew up in Mexico, live in the United States. Maybe he's the patron saint of people who grew up in Mexico, now live in the United States.
Absolutely.
Comic book hero. Never made it on TV, which is actually good.
He made one movie, though.
Oh, did he really? Yes, I didn't see it.
He did.
Okay.
You got to really be a true fan to know about the movie.
And you are.
Horrible.
You are a true fan. Welcome to L.A.
Thank you, Adolfo. I'm absolutely honored to be here with all of you guys. Thank you. Gracias. Thank you.
Now, the first time you came to Los Angeles, it was a short flight from San Diego to Los Angeles International, to LAX. It was January 2nd, 1987, you were 19 years old.
Just 19.
And you had spent the last 24 hours doing a lot of exciting stuff.
Yes.
Tell me about the first arrival in L.A.
Well,
what had
it's
happened.
Quite interesting, obviously. I think that you put it beautifully in words. I had tried to cross the border, as I recollect in my recent book, and I hopped the fence, and I got caught, just like a lot of people do. And I was young, and I really didn't measure danger the same way I do today. Experience, you know, tells you a lot of things. But at that time, I was hungry. I'm not talking about hungry for success. I was literally hungry. You know, I needed food. You know, so I wanted to come to the United States, and I got caught. And one of the things that I learned very early on, which is one of the lessons that I tell our youth nowadays, is perseverance. So I went back, and I didn't make the same mistake twice.
You learned that you had to be 30 seconds quicker.
Yes, and also time it. Because, you know, at the time, you know, I mean, obviously it would be much more challenging today, virtually impossible. But at the time, they had a routine, you know. And I came back, and like out of a movie, I remember laying down on the side of the border like this and watching. And timing,
it was a Kaliman
watching.
Move.
It was a Kaliman maneuver. And I was watching them, you know. And then finally I said, time it. And then I jumped that fence the second time, and I was so fast. The adrenaline rushing through your body, as you can imagine. I mean, I just hopped two or three times like a spider, jumped over, because remember the actual barbed wire is angled.
This was in Calexico?
This was in Calexico. Yeah. The barbed wire is wire, so when you go to the top, you got to literally leap your body over and just jump. You can't go back into the wire. You literally have to jump all the way from the top and land at the bottom. I'm surprised that I didn't break an ankle or something.
Now you get to San Diego, you make it on the flight. Obviously, this is pre-9/11. You know, you don't really have to show anything.
Well, you have to realize that I thought, I was looking American. I bought myself a pair of Bugle Boys and a Le Tigre shirt.
Bugle Boys.
Yes. Remember those really big pants and stuff like that? And I thought I was looking American. Now I look pictures. I mean, I was clearly not. But nonetheless, I thought I was fitting right in. I went and bought myself a nice ticket for about $63, if I remember correctly. I don't know how I did it. I couldn't speak the language, but I just showed up. They didn't ask me for an ID pre-11. I jumped in the plane, and before I could think about it, I was so nervous. I'd never been in an airplane before. I land in L.A.
Now, your friend is supposed to be waiting for you at LAX with your Thunderbird, right? How many hours did you have to wait for him before you actually found him?
Well, if memory serves me well, I was probably taking one of the late night flights, and I landed in L.A. maybe around 9 or 10 p.m., and he didn't show up until the next day for about 24 hours.
What'd you eat? Know?
Well, so I had about $1.50 left, all right? So I had and that's when I got introduced, you know, to fast food for about $1. I bought a cheeseburger or something. Then the money was gone. So I ended up going to the tables. I remember I used to watch, and you know, we in America, and I am guilty of that nowadays, we waste a lot of food. If you sit right there and you watch people sometimes, especially in airports, they leave food on the tables because they're in a rush. They come in, and especially families with their kids. So they were leaving food. So I would just be catching them, and I would go in and sit right there as soon as they left. And I would eat the leftovers, which were perfectly fine. And that's how I fed myself for about 24 hours.
Before we talk about you ending up in the San Joaquin Valley Community College, UC Berkeley, that sort of thing, let's talk about Palaco near Mexicali. Now, I remember as a kid making those trips in the summertime to central Mexico, and we'd drive through Mexicali in August. And, I mean, the heat kind of dries up your skin. It just, you know, kind of shrinks it, right? But you have some great memories in the book about being a kid in Palaco, and I never hear you complain about the heat. What? Tell me about growing up in the Mexicali Valley.
It was interesting. I had dinner with my parents last night, and they were looking at the weather in Mexicali, and it was really hot. And I was looking back at my time. I remember that I was telling my mom, we used to have this little sort of a box with ice, and I remember that I used to go in the middle of the night and grab ice and just put it on my face. Because back then, we didn't have cold water. You had to go to the store and buy those blocks of ice. We didn't have a refrigerator. And it was oppressive. The heat was incredible. But I got to tell you, I remember, you know, I talk about that in the book, how we used to go to the top, you know, on the top of the house just to get a little bit of air, you know, and the mosquitoes were, you know, incredibly tough.
Because they grow a lot of things. I mean, this is their farm. I mean, it's the desert, but they farm.
Well, the farm, there's water, remember, that comes from the Colorado River. So, and it's incredible. And, you know, but we had a great time, I tell you. I mean, I can't complain. I mean, you can focus on the heat. You can focus on the fact that sometimes we didn't have food and things like that. And, you know, I recollect a lot of these things now. You can tell nowadays. I sit here with my pink shirt, fancy, and I don't pick these shirts, by the way. They pick them up for me nowadays. I got my, you know, my cufflinks and my suits and stuff. But back then, we didn't have anything. And I got to tell you, but I have fun memories. You know, I talk about one particular experience with these kids. You know, so now I'm going to introduce Kaliman because you got to hear about this, all right? This is the superhero.
El
so
hombre increíble.
Incredible man, you know, Kaliman, you know. So I was about 5 or 6 years old, and these kids were chasing us all over the place. And I had a lot of, I was one, and my father alone, I was one of 55 cousins, you know. And these kids were really bad kids. They would just hunt us with little BB guns and do all kinds of horrific things to us. And I needed to get you know, get tough. So one day I was telling my brother, Gabriel, and my three cousins, Arturo, Eduardo, and Antonio. And I said, guys, get around here. Surround me, four of you guys, because I'm going to pull the Kaliman maneuver on you guys. They said, the Kaliman what? The Kaliman maneuver. Four guys surround you. You jump in the air. You catch two with your fist and two with your feet. And they all go down. So they are like, no, please, don't do this. You're going to hurt us. I said, relax. I'm going to take it easy on you. I won't hurt anybody today. But we got to be ready for those kids. So I put them all there. And remember, this is dust. So I jump in the air and boom, landed on my belly. Completely out of air. You know, and I am like eating dust. And I turn over and I look, all four of them, they're looking at me like this. They couldn't believe it. All right? And then suddenly they bust in laughter. And I am barely breathing, but I learned something right there and then. This is how arrogant I was, even as a little kid, all right? I said, if I can't do it, it's impossible that Kaliman can do it either.
I love it. I love it. You know, now, we'll let people read the book and find the instances when you're the perpetrator, you know, and you have your own victims, okay? Tell me about Tata Juan and Nana Maria, your grandparents.
They are, you know, superheroes. They're the true Kalimans, you know. My grandfather was a great man, humble beginnings, grew up as an orphan. His mother, now that we look back, I'm beginning to understand that she probably has some sort of, you know, mental breakdown when her husband, my grandfather's father, died, went through depression, bipolar disorder, as I put it back, talking to him and my aunts and uncles. And yet, he struggled a lot, too, with alcoholism when he was a young man, trying to find his own way. But yet, he was so incredibly bright. He learned how to play almost every instrument as a little boy without just listening. You know, some people are gifted. I'm not that way, you know. And he learned how to play every single instrument. And, you know, since he was about 6 years old, he would go to the little cantinas and play and make money to support his mother and stuff like that. Eventually married my Nana, my grandmother, Maria, who was an incredibly wise woman, super
bright. She was
a
curandera.
She was a curandera.
A healer.
She was also the woman who was in charge of delivering all the babies in the community. And she was so bright that there were the doctors who were very prominent in the small town in Mexicali, which is northern Baja California. They would want to hire her. But she was someone who provided care for people who needed it. And she always chose her patients and her family instead of making money.
There was an instance where your sister contracts diarrhea. And you were 3 years old and they take her to Nana
Maria. My earliest memories, Abby, you're talking about my sister Maricela, who the book was dedicated to. She died of the number one cause of death in developing countries in children, which is diarrhea. Up until today, even though I study brain cancer, the truth is diarrhea kills more children in the world than anything else, in just lack of water. And my grandmother recognized that there was something not right with her. So this is when she encouraged my dad and my mom to bring her to the town, to the city of Mexicali, where there was a hospital. and tried to, you know, care for her, but it was unfortunately too late. She was already completely dehydrated. She went into, now that I understand as a neurosurgeon, she went into seizures, you know, epilepsy, complete dehydration. That means that her sodium was very elevated. You know, that means that you're really dehydrated, and it's very dangerous not to bring it down. And unfortunately, my father and my mother saw her die. We never really talked about it, Adolfo, to be honest with you. It was a painful moment in my family history. And I'm sure it was also the beginnings of my own father dealing with a lot of his own issues, including his, you know, struggle with alcohol and stuff like that. And as I remember back in my early memories. But I chose to focus on the positive things that came out of that. My mom surfaced as an incredible, powerful source of strength in our family.
And your Tata Juan seems to be this great grandfather figure who takes you to the different part, the Rumorosa, which, if you know Mexicali, is the mountain range. It's almost like, you know, the place where after God's creating the world, he puts all the leftover rocks there, right?
Yes.
You know, it's a beautiful place, and it's cool up there because it's a couple thousand feet above Mexicali. And he took you up there, but he took you roundabout ways and all that, right?
We did a lot of adventures. He was a man who taught me not to go where there was a path, by going instead where there was no path and leave a trail. And I think those values were instilled in me at a very early age. And my aunt was talking about this last night, my father's sister, because she came in to have dinner with us. And she said, I remember vividly when you were a little kid and my dad used to walk, you know, come in driving in this old green car that he had. It was a Plymouth, you know, very old. And I'll be behind him standing up like a little kid, just like a little dog, you know, looking all over the place, and we would go to so many adventures. And then he would be taking me home and said, oh, he's going to get rid of this kid, because I was not very well liked by my aunts, by the way, because I was, as you know, as you alluded to, I got into a lot of trouble. And then somehow I convinced my grandfather to bring me back with him. So he would make a trip to deliver me to my parents, and yet he ended up with me back. So he was a great man.
I'd like you to read page 51. And this is, your Tata Juan's passing away.
It's a powerful moment, obviously, in my book. My tears began to fall helplessly. In recent months, with cancer slowly and painfully killing him, I had visited often but rarely gotten him to talk much. Though I had seen him declining, I wasn't ready to say goodbye. In the otherwise silent room, the sound of his breathing and the ticking of a small clock near his bedside were unforgettable. Then my grandfather slowly opened his eyes and asked softly, do you remember when we would go to the Rumorosa Mountains? Yes, I do, always. Me too. You used to call me Tata, Tata. I remember. You know, he said, just before he closed his eyes and offered a final smile, I really enjoyed those times. Tata's dying message assured me that I should not be afraid to climb mountains, no matter how treacherous, and that I could even take joy in doing so. He wasn't telling me how to do, but wanted me to know that I could continue to call him wherever I felt lost. After Nana Maria passed away 2 years later, I felt her presence with me too, though her message was to be careful and to look out for pitfalls. I hope she forgave me for not being at her side more when she was dying. After a lifetime as a healer, helping to bring hundreds of lives into the world, Nana went to the grave knowing that no one had ever died in her care. But I was surprised to learn from my father that until the end, she was afraid of death, and especially the loneliness of not knowing what was on the other side. My father also told me that in spite of her fear, when her time came, she was ready. Nana discovered that many of us will never know until we are there, that no matter how many times we defy the odds, we all reach the moment where the only way out is surrender. Until then, give it everything. And I eventually, thank you. As you know, I tie this to a future episode in my life. You know, and there are very, very symbolic moments that happen in one's life.
Right around this time, your teenage years unfortunately coincide with Mexico's first severe economic crisis. Your father loses the gas station, the Pemex station that provides the family income, right? Your studies are going well. You want to become a teacher, a school teacher. And in Mexico, it happens, you can become a school teacher at the high school level, right? You can study Escuela Normal.
That's correct.
Escuela Normal. And you come up against the nepotism and the favoritism and the family connections. And you're hoping that merit will put you in a good position. You're hoping, but when you come across that in the book, you talk about how that really affects you. That this country, the country of your birth, doesn't recognize your merit.
It is true, as you know, in developing countries, it's not uncommon that sometimes to move upwards, you really have to know people, and I came from humble backgrounds. And the fact that I couldn't get a position near my parents at the time that I finished my studies to become an elementary school teacher, I was only 18 years old at the time. I was just a kid. I was also about a couple of years younger than everybody else. And it really crushed me, to be honest with you. I felt as if I love my country, and we were going through a lot of episodes of hunger, as I said before, literally, and the country was going through a crisis in the late 70s, early 80s. This is 83, 86.
The devaluation of the peso.
But it was right. The crisis was all over the world. It was the United States had one of the strongest and the deepest recessions that we have had, obviously, up until the recent one. So the whole world was being affected, and I was just on an island. I didn't know any better. But this obviously had a profound effect. And if you think about it, this is also around the time that my uncle, and I talk about the book, started to stimulate a part of the brain that is called the limbic system. All right? The limbic system is, if you are hungry, you give someone food, and they're loyal to you. So that's exactly what was going on. My uncle would bring food from the United States, sacks of potatoes and rice and beans, and we were their little kids, teenagers, hungry. And I was wondering, well, wait a minute, how come my uncle goes and works in the United States as a migrant farm worker and he can afford to bring us food? So somewhere back in your brain, something is being stimulated. And I do that nowadays in research all the time, obviously, as I understand the function of the brain. But that's how the idea began to be born, that one day, maybe, I was going to leave my country.
And at first, your parents don't want to let you go, but you have a passport, you have a tourist visa before they take it away from you a couple of years later. So you're able to cross. You're not supposed to work with that tourist visa, but you do.
You have to understand the dynamics. It was only a passport, literally, to cross the border and to be within 25 miles of the border. It's literally just to cross right there and to be only for hours.
But you kept going to Mendota. Yes. You kept going near Fresno, right?
Yes.
And
I
you worked
it.
There.
I pushed it. I pushed it several times, actually. I did. I started working as a migrant farm worker since I was 14 years old. And I would come in my first summer. I was literally 14. And I talk about how my uncle said impossible. I was 96 pounds. I got really skinny. This is really a time when we were going through a difficult time in my house. And I remember seeing my father crying in the back of the house that he couldn't provide. So I said, forget it. I'm going to leave. I was already working since I was 5 years old. So I left. Came to Mendota, California, up north, to San Joaquin Valley, and I asked my uncle for a job. And he wouldn't give it to me. And I recollect the stories. And he says, give me 5 reasons as to why I should give you a job. And I don't remember the first 4 that I gave him. I made up some sort of stories here and there. And the last one was very straightforward. I said, because we need it. Very few people understood what was going on. So I ended up pulling weeds that summer, my very first summer. In the United States. And I remember vividly, by the time I came back, and I talk about that in the book, he wanted me to take care of myself, to buy some clothes, a pair of pants or something. And he took me to a store, and he forced me to buy a pair of 501s. And they were about $17 at the time. And I remember that I didn't want to spend a single penny. At the end, I cried, and I agreed. And then when I was leaving, he gave me a Walkman. At the time, you can put tapes. And I always wanted to have one of those things. And I came back, and I was down to about 80 pounds. And as you can imagine, my parents were devastated. And I remember I reached down and I had saved all my summer savings, about $900 that I had on my shoe that I brought into my parents. And that provided us food for the whole year, actually.
I think this is a little bit later, but when your mother finally comes, I think it's to Stockton, she sees the dirt caked on your clothes, on your hands, in your fingernails. And here's the son she believed was going to become a school teacher, was going to rise up in the family. Does she cry?
Yes, of course. I mean, it was powerful for them. I mean, remember, I was on the first one. Actually, I was the second one to be educated in my family, but my first cousin died in a car accident from traumatic brain injury, actually. And I became the first one. And I was supposed to be the hope that there would be someone in our extended family that would be educated. And it just didn't happen that way in Mexico. So when she came to the United States, now we're talking about 18, 19 years old, 1987, 88. And I am, you know, up to my head on mud and dirt and grease, and I'm working on the fields. And she was devastated, you know, and my father was devastated. And this was my uncle told him, this is his future. He's going to spend the rest of his life working like this.
As a neurosurgeon, you bring people back from the dead, practically. You've had some near-death experiences. One of them in particular. How old were you? You were refurbishing tanks. These were railroad tanks, right? Liquefied petroleum tanks. You describe how you go up the ladder, take off, I guess, the main cover with some kind of large wrench,
yes.
Right? There's a section. Is it page 89 where you talk
89.
About that?
Yeah. So let me set the scenario. I mean, this is highly skilled work. I didn't know any better.
How old are you?
I was about this time. I was about 21. Okay. Highly skilled work. I mean, this is highly pressurized valves. By this time, I had already trained as a welder, and I had gone from working in the fields now to starting at the bottom of this company, and within a year, rising to the top, just like what I had done in the fields too. Remember, even though I started pulling weeds, within a year, I was driving some of the most sophisticated machines. Same thing with welding.
And which before is, college.
Before was, college. Yeah. Which incidentally, people wonder, what does that have to do with brain surgery? What I can tell you, if you look at me operating in the operating room today, I sit in a chair that looks like an astronaut chair, and I connect to my patients. I control everything with my feet. In my hands, I operate, and the microscope, I control it with my mouth and my feet, and I am operating all the time. It was similar, except the mouthpiece for this machinery. When I was welding, I mean, you have to weld certain level of a skill that comes along with that, and that's what nowadays I do that with blood vessels and tumors. I believe the stakes are much higher than, you know, a brain. I can't compare the brain with a piece of metal or a piece of tomato, but, you know, nonetheless, the skills, the motor skills that it takes, you know, the tension is different. But that's what I did, obviously. And so I am here. I was fixing these incredible tanks, and I find myself at the bottom of one of them, dying. All right? So this is page 89. Then on April 14th, 1989, my promising future came crashing down after my plunge to the bottom of the railway tank and my unsuccessful attempt to climb out. As I lay unconscious without oxygen, face down, dying. Of course, I recall that moment, not from my direct experience of it, but from reports given to me years later by those who were there, accounts that were as difficult for them to give me as they were for me to hear. For my father, all of his worst nightmares were realized the instant he saw Pablo's face and understood that my coworker had let go of my hand. After he heard the thud reverberating in the tank, my father's screams were momentarily silenced, and he was joined by my brother-in-law, Ramon. On one side of him was Agustin, carrying ropes and a collapsible ladder on the other side. They arrived in time to hold my father back as they looked down to see that I had fallen with my knees bent slightly under me, my body in a fetal position. I can only imagine my father's desperate frustration, knowing that he had been so close to being able to save me. By all accounts, including his own, he went mad. And with the sound of Don Mateo praying loudly as he still knelt by the side of the tracks, my father lurched forward, attempting to enter the tank. thrashing and fighting the others as they sought to calm him. The more they tried to reason with him, explaining that he would die if he went in, the more Papa fought off their efforts to restrain him. Agustin reminded my father that he was too broad-shouldered to fit through the opening, not to mention too old to risk the rescue. Thinking back to what my father must have felt here in this at the same age that I am today, I can't imagine how I would react if someone told me that I couldn't attempt to save my children's lives. You know, and that's exactly, you know, what happened. But it was a miracle. I mean, and I go through the whole collection. I mean, it was just, these guys were amazing. With limited resources, they were able to save my life. You know, and they brought me back. But I was in that, so I ended up in the hospital, and I go through this whole thing. The memories are incredible. It's like, to me, I'm excited about my own book, but to go back and tell the stories is amazing. You know, I'm passionate about almost everything I do. I never lose passion for anything. So I ended up in the hospital, all right? And I am vomiting, I'm thrashing, and I'm in the yellow stretcher, the same yellow stretcher that I use nowadays to take care of my patients that have brain injuries or whatever. And I am vomiting, and the doctors tell me, relax. And I say, how do you want me to relax? I can't breathe. I have a C-spine, you know, retractor right here, a stabilizer, cervical spine. And then I finally calm down. And my father, like an hour later, after they did MRI, CT scans, and all that kind of stuff, he said that he knew I was going to be okay because I was paying attention, and I saw some really attractive young nurses. And then, and then I asked my father, hey, Dad, is my hair looking okay? So he knew I was going to be fine.
So thanks to Republican administrations in California and the United States, you get your green card. California starts regularizing farm workers, and that sort of thing. And then through amnesty, Ronald Reagan, 1986, you get your residency, and then later on you become a citizen. Now, let's skip community college, UC Berkeley. In reading about your later years at UC Berkeley, you come across counselors, professors who see your achievement, your ambition, your grades. And it's almost, I think even one of them, one of the people you go to is referred to as Obi-Wan Kenobi. And they start to see you as almost the chosen one, you know. And tell me about the one person who saw your transcripts, your grades and everything, and his reaction once you start considering medical schools and where to go.
Well, that was actually Hugo Mora, you know, who incidentally, and I talk about this in the book, his sister had died of brain cancer. And there's a house at UC Berkeley, it's called the Mora House. You know, after her, she was an activist in the 70s and 80s, actually, at UC Berkeley. So Hugo, I don't know if he ever called me the chosen one, because he's the one who also took the picture of me seeing my first cadaver, and it's in the book, and I was pale, white.
That's great, you know, because it's a Dia de los Muertos. They say, oh, we're going to have a Dia de los Muertos at Stanford. And you're thinking, yes. Oh, great, connect with my roots. But it ends up being like a lab and a cadaver. Yes. And
I thought we were going to be eating candy and dancing and stuff like that. Instead, we were in a cadaver lab, in a laboratory looking at bodies. So, but a few months prior, he goes, you know, I am going to meet you at Bancroft, the Café Strata. Which, incidentally, I was there 2 weeks ago at UC Berkeley, and I had a coffee, a double espresso, in the very same place that I had my first double espresso ever. And you can tell already, I don't drink coffee very much. And,
really?
And back then, I was even more energized. So I go in, same deal, you know. I pay attention to the people in front of me, and I was single at the time. I hadn't met my wife yet. And I figured this was an international coffee, and there were a lot of attractive women. So I wanted to connect with someone. And I go in and I notice that they are ordering some kind of white drink with foam. And the person in front of me says, double espresso. And I said, that sounds about right. So I order a double espresso. It comes out with a small little cup like this. I mean, half of this. And I zip it and I finish it. And I go home. I have a final the next day. And I go to the final, and my heart is going boom, 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 boom. No sleep for about 24 hours. So I sat there last week, and it was in the same place where Hugo met me. And I remember Hugo looked at my transcripts. He goes, I want you to look, show me your transcripts, and we're going to decide what you're going to do. I decided that I wasn't going to go to law school. I really didn't have anything in common with lawyers. Nothing wrong against lawyers, but I just...
Some
of my best friends are lawyers, but it just didn't fit my personality. And then he looks at my transcripts, and then he looks at me, long hair, earrings on both sides, goatee, and then he looks at me. He just couldn't believe it. He goes to me, Vato, you know, with these grades and what you have done, you can go to Harvard if you want to. And I'm thinking to myself, this guy is living la vida loca. I mean, clearly, he has no idea what he's talking about. But he was the first one, you know, that identified that there was something. That's how I began, you know, to be mentored.
Well, and what's interesting is that, you know, over the last 30 years, there have been, you know, educators who are in the various institutions, Chicano educators, who help others come up, and you had people open doors for you. I mean, who was it that gave you the names of two Harvard Medical School professors and say, when you go to Harvard, you have to look up these people?
That's correct. That was also at Berkeley. It was Joe Martinez. Joe Martinez has done many things for me, but the things that I talk specifically in my book is number one. When I came into his laboratory that's how I got introduced to research. He said, you're coming to my laboratory not to wash dishes, which I had already been doing for about 2 years at Berkeley prior to that. He goes, you're coming here to explore the universe. And he linked it without knowing to the fact that when I was a little kid, I wanted to be an astronaut and I wanted to navigate the universe. That's when I used to be at the top of the roof of my house looking at the stars. And now, how little did I know that one day I was going to be navigating the greatest universe, the greatest universe that we know, which is our brain. And I get to do it every single day. And he said, you're going to do this, and I believe that you're going to have your own research proposal. And that was my very first publication. I looked, and I'm going to throw some names right here just for the young students who are studying biology. I look at the connection, the monosynaptic connection and long-term potentiation between the lateral and rhino cortex and the nucleus accumbens. At the time, I couldn't even pronounce any of these words, of course. But that's what I looked at. And he believed in me. And when I went, the second thing that he did is when I went to Harvard, he gave me a little sticky. And he has very small writing. He goes, you got to meet these two guys, Ed Kravitz and David Potter at Harvard Medical School.
Two very different people. One, immigrant, Jewish immigrant roots. Another from, you know, a well-off, long-established Eastern Seaboard family. So absolutely, you got two very different perspectives. This is not to say that you didn't have merit. Of course you had merit. You had worked hard. But there were people along the way who helped you out and opened doors for you.
No question. There are wonderful people in the United States. And I always tell our students, when you look for mentorship, you don't have to look for people that look like you. As a matter of fact, I encourage you to go outside of what you know, because these are the people who are going to hold you up in a higher standard. They're going to push you. And that's exactly what they did with me in different ways. I talk about an incredible story with Ed Kravitz. I thought I was the man. And I wrote a paper. I had written a paper with Joe Martinez. So I wrote another paper, an abstract, and I show it to Ed Kravitz. And he looks at it, and I talk about this incredible interaction that we had. And after he finished, he was using a red pen. And my abstract was about half a page, and the whole page was red. I couldn't even see my words anymore. And he looks at me, and he noticed that I was completely shocked. And he looks at me, he passed. He goes, don't worry about it. You've done a great job, but there's a lot more work to do. So that's the relationship.
Dr. Q, you talk about working hard. You talk about ambition. I interview a lot of people in public schools, a lot of high school students. I see the whole range of their achievement, home life, home situation, and prospects, that sort of thing. What about those who do work hard, do have ambition, but maybe don't have the support of parents like you did, don't have people helping them out, don't have people opening doors for them, don't have the charisma you do?
Well, I would say that I wasn't always like this. I mean, if you ask my wife, when she first met me, I ran away. I ran the other way, literally. And this is exactly the title of my book, is Becoming Dr. Q, because I am not who I want to be yet. And I have evolved, obviously. I mean, there is a certain amount of inner fire that one must have, and I always have had that kind of ambition to do today better than I did yesterday. And I never compete against people. I compete against myself. And today, every time I go home and I go to sleep, I wonder, could I have done it better? So I always tell students, and I chose throughout my life to concentrate in the positive things about my life. If you look, I talk about incredible experiences, death, you know, discrimination, racism, but I chose not to focus on that. You remember the story at UC Berkeley when I took my first exam in physical anthropology, and I got a C-. And I had never gotten a C-, all right? And it's not a problem getting a C-. I don't think it's an issue. But the issue for me is that I study harder than I had ever studied for an exam. And I thought I was going to ace that exam. So it brought me down. It showed me about being humble. And I remember that what happened is that I didn't know that the professor was professing things that had nothing to do with the exam. You know, I would sit there and take diligent notes about this. And it turns out that the TAs, the teaching assistants, were the ones making the exam, and they were selling the notes in a service. And you go and buy the notes, and then you knew more or less what was going to be in the exam. So I pulled my grade in the next two exams, because we're in a semester system at UC Berkeley, to an A- at the end of that. And there I am in Cafe Strada sitting with my TA and a few, about five or six students, and she goes around and asks, where are you from, where are you from?
What do you think of the Dream Act students over the last year and the, you know, being unafraid, coming out, being so visible? What do you think of that?
It is hard. I'm not going to lie to you. I think that a lot of people are intimidated in many ways by that stigma that goes along. And I link that to the same story that I was telling you when it comes to me and he asked me where I am from. And I said, all proud of myself, I said, I'm from Mexico. And she looks at me. And I think that she was trying to give me a compliment. She goes, you can't be from Mexico. You're too smart to be from Mexico. All right? So the stigma carries a long way. You ask about this whole idea of how students feel about it. I'm an arrogant SOB. I'm not going to lie to you. All right? Can I use that word, SOB? It's not a bad word, so I know they're filming. But I mean, to be able to do what I do. But that affected me for the next 7 years of my life. And it was not until I was at Harvard, given the commencement speech, and I had to prepare my speech, that I had to reflect after driving across country with my wife and my six-month-old daughter. I had to reflect about that, about the opportunities that I was given in this country, about the fact that what people saw as a harsh decree, it was nothing else but what made me different than everybody else. And that's when I began to really take advantage in being proud of who I was.
Do you support the Dream Act?
I do. Obviously, one of the challenges that we have is how do you make it in such a way that is that will benefit not only the students, you know, several thousand students in the United States, I think, in California will qualify, but also will benefit the state. And today I was actually in a show this morning, and a very young, brilliant young woman said to me, you know, why can't we do the Dream Act and we provide financial aid to X amount of students, but you tell them when you finish, you will have to pay back X amount of work, no different than what the NIH has done with me in helping me pay for my loans. They have guaranteed that I will continue to do work as an academic surgeon to try to advance the field. So there are ways to work and be smart in such a way that it doesn't sound like you're just throwing money away, but rather investing in the future of our country.
And then what about... Does that mean open borders? Does that mean...
You know, it is a complex issue, Adolfo. I mean, I don't have an answer. I always tell people, I'm not a politician. I'm not an expert in economics. I'm just a simple brain surgeon as a scientist. All right? And I spent my whole life... Thank you. I spent my whole life trying to become the best brain surgeon I can possibly be at Johns Hopkins, you know. And I have spent my whole life trying to become the best scientist that I can be. So I don't have answers, to be honest with you. But I can tell you one thing, and I said it over and over. As long as there is hunger, as long as there is poverty in our neighboring countries, and as long as people can dream, and I can assure you that if you have a brain, you can dream. People will dream about a better life. And doesn't matter how tall and how complex those borders are built, people will find their way.
Let's hear page 286. Could you set up steel, this? You're talking, this section is about steel in your soul. Tell me about.
So this is in page 286. I tell you, so I am blessed every single day to do what I do. I mean, imagine that. I mentioned that I get to navigate the universe and I get to hold it in my hands. But along with this comes an incredible amount of responsibility and the lessons that I have learned. You talk about mentorship. And I have been mentored by a lot of people in my life, most recently by my own patients. And in difficult moments, I still try to get something that I can pass on to my other patients. And this is a story of an interaction with a young couple that just breaks my heart. And you'll see the power. And why is it that my patients are my heroes? So I am doing a very complex surgery on a patient. And I'm setting up the stage in my conversation with the patient. I will never forget walking into an exam room with devastating news for my patient, Sharon, a young mother in her early 20s who had traveled to Baltimore from out of state with her husband, a soldier just returned from an overseas tour of duty. When the couple arrived at the clinic, we first talked about their two children, a toddler and a baby, and the joys and challenges of parenting. Sharon was bright-eyed, thoughtful, and stoic when I described the surgery and the follow-up treatment for what I suspected was a high-grade malignant tumor, probably similar to what Senator Kennedy had not too long ago. We were able to reach her primary care doctor back home, put him on the speakerphone, and coordinate a plan of action for when she returned to be able to take a biopsy from a very dangerous part of the brain. It's called the brainstem. Everything went perfectly in the operating room from a technical standpoint, but when I removed the tumor and sent it for an intraoperative test, it was exactly what I suspected, a glioblastoma multiforme. In my postoperative meeting with Sharon and her husband, I first commented on her courage. And by the way, I said, as you sit here today, you look great. What's your secret? With a nervous smile, she said, brain surgery. I then had to tell them that my worst fear had been confirmed about the nature of the tumor and describe the best and worst case scenarios for life expectancy. Of course, we had treatment options and would be vigilant in applying them. Sometimes in such meetings with patients, I explained that numbers mean little and that it is not helpful to put a finite limit on life on time left. But Sharon and her husband insisted on knowing the general expectations so they could plan. I told them that we would try to buy more time and stave off an immediate progression. Another year would be a blessing, but we would try for two more years. At that moment, they realized with sudden certainty that she was really going to die. Sharon then did something that I will remember for the rest of my life. She turned to her husband, put her hand on his knee, and as both of them gave in to tears, she looked into his eyes, saying softly but powerfully, "I love you." With those three words, she said everything that she knew he would be left with two little children to raise without their mother, that he would live the rest of his life without his soulmate and partner. She was not thinking of herself at that moment, only of her loved ones. Thank you. It's a powerful moment. She did die, as you can imagine, not too long after that, just a few months. She had an incredibly complex tumor in parts of the brain where we just can't operate. And that's one of the reasons why my patients inspire me. You know, people ask me, why is it that I love the brain? And I have a passage in my book, but I can summarize it by saying that the brain is a symbol. It's a symbol of what our world should be like. Our lives should be like. When I remove the skin to one side, and I remove the bone, and I remove the dura that covers the brain, and I look at the brain dances with such a beautiful rhythm. And every brain that I look dances with a very similar rhythm. And I see the rivers of blood vessels, the different gyra that form the brain with such an incredible beauty. And I can tell whether you're Jewish, Muslim, Catholic, Christian. I can tell whether you're white, black, Asian, or any other nationality. I can tell, by the way, whether you have an accent. Sometimes people think that if you have an accent, you think with an accent. I can tell you with a certain level of authority, I don't think you can tell. And I love the brain for that reason. You can tell the difference.
How many operations do you do a year?
I do about 250 to 300, actually, operations. And I see about 1,500 patients. My life doesn't end the moment that I come here, by the way.
I talked to you a couple of days ago for my movie Mental Column on KCT.org. Please look for it. It was 7 o'clock Baltimore time. You had started the day at 5 in the morning.
Yes.
You weren't done yet. You talk in the book about standing up your wife for a White House soiree, and she was all dressed up. You talk about the compromises you've had to make. There's a high price. It's a very high price. This all reminded me of something the Time editor Walter Isaacson wrote recently on Steve Jobs. He's writing the biography of Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs has been a very private person, but opened up to Walter Isaacson. And on his practically on his deathbed, Isaacson asked Jobs, "Why?" And he said, "Well, I haven't been around for my kids for, I wanted them to know why, and I wanted them to know why I did it." Does that resonate with you?
Of course, and I got to tell you, obviously I'm just a regular guy. I'm not a genius like Steve Jobs, and I really do mean it. And I hope that people can relate to my story and realize that the American dream is not Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, but it's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And when you find your passion, which in my case is brain surgery, brain science research, and I use the brain as a symbol to trying to find a cure for the cancer that afflicts the most beautiful organ, which is the brain. If we can find a cure for that, imagine what other cures we can find in our society, the cancer that affects our society. People talk. They say, once it related to this issue of the beauty of the brain, baseball players, they hit home runs, all right? Football players, they hit touchdowns. They get touchdowns. I get to do that every single day in the operating room. I get to hit home runs. I get to score touchdowns. And when I go into the waiting room, I get a standing ovation from my patients. And they hug me, and they cry with me, and they're happy that I have been able to save their loved ones' lives. But there is a price that one pays, and I call it the price of triumph. Now, I'm 43 years old, and I am trying to remedy exactly that situation where I don't want my kids 10 years from now not to know me. I want them to know who I am, and that's the reason why I wrote this book. I want them to know early on, in their early years, who their father is, who hasn't been around for the last 20 years or so, all right? And that has been one of the greatest challenges, how to balance your life, But it is not a secret. I mean, the American dream is still alive today, just like it was alive 100 years ago. We're still making the same mistakes, by the way.
For other ethnic groups, for Italians, for Jews, for, who have now been accepted, yet Mexican-Americans been quite accepted.
We are making the same mistakes, and that ties to this. 100, 200 years ago, things were rough. We got to blame the Irish. Things were tough. We got to blame the Italians, and so on and so forth. And now who are we blaming? Immigrants.
Yeah. At this point, I have to check in with Louise. Let's open up for questions. So think about a question. Raise your hand.
Thank you.
And I'll let the people with the microphones take the microphone to whoever they want. Just tell us your name and.
Hi. Good evening, and welcome to Los Angeles. And we hope you come back to.
Thank
work
you.
And practice over here. My name is Rachel Santos, and I've had Parkinson's since early 1990, and it's been a struggle. Do you have any information on the progress of the stem cells?
Of course. No, thank you. That's a wonderful question, Rachel, if I remember correctly your name. I think that the work that we're doing in my laboratory, even though we're concentrating mainly on brain cancer, we are unraveling the mysteries of the human brain, because that's what I really work. And we believe in the human brain. There are stem cells. Thank you for coming. There are stem cells. The secret and the challenge is going to be, how do we take advantage of them? All right. And I would say that in the next 2 to 3 decades, I'm not sure, Rachel, that you would be a direct beneficiary of this. But you are part of history. By the fact that you talk about this, people are becoming part of history. That's what I do in my laboratory. In the next 2 to 3 decades, I think that a lot of neurological disorders are going to become chronic diseases rather than devastating diseases that affect your quality of life.
Thank you. Is there another question?
Hello, my name is Carlos, undergraduate at UC San Diego. I saw you about a week and a half ago up in UC Davis. And my question is, just quickly, my mom wanted to be here, but she couldn't make it. She just went through a hysterectomy because of adenocarcinoma. It was found, however, at stage zero because she gets that yearly checkup. How do we get everyone in here to get their yearly checkup to, in order to prevent, you know, or to stop cancer at an early stage?
Well, as you know, you're absolutely right. Cancer affects hundreds of thousands of people, and I'd be surprised if I was to ask, everybody in this room probably has been affected themselves, or they know someone in their family or a friend or someone who has been affected by cancer. I think we are getting better. Now, I am an expert on brain cancer. I study other cancers just by virtue that they end up in the brain. But we've gotten so good at treating other cancers, breast cancers, lung cancer, even though they're still devastating diseases, we are getting better. The brain has proven to be a challenge. And the life expectancy of a patient with brain cancer is about a year and a half at the most right now. So it is still a devastating disease. We are getting better at diagnosing it, MRIs, screening, you know, knowing, being aware of some of the symptoms, obviously, being educated and knowing what to look for, obviously, and have a regular checkup with your primary care physicians certainly is helping us to diagnose these cancers better, specifically the brain. But I think that's a wonderful question. I think that we need to be smart as to how we spend our money. And the fact that we have over 40 million Americans without insurance makes that job much more challenging.
We have a question from the top deck up here.
Hi, I'm Karen. I'm from Baltimore. Go Ravens.
Go Ravens. We won this last weekend, by the way.
we're kicking butt. But I'm here with my students from Evans Adult School. We're in a reading class, and I wondered if you could tell us something about how reading affected your life and your studies.
Well, I got to tell you. So people ask me when I went to Berkeley, why is it that I took science classes? The truth is I was a psychology major, for the reason that I needed to challenge myself. I needed to learn how to speak better English and how to write better English. And fortunately, a lot of the psychology exams are essays. So I needed to read a lot and write a lot. And I did my science classes not knowing that they were going to help me for medical school because that helped me keep my GPA high. Alrighty, so that I did better because it's a universal language. So I always encourage students, you have to be good at science, good at math, and you have to read a lot. Every single day, it affects a part of your brain. You know, it's called the temporal lobe. I mean, it's that simple. And I test it every day when I'm in the operating room. And some of the surgeries that I talk about, I do this. So it has clearly an effect on the plasticity and the way that the brain is molded. But I tell you, the other thing that is enjoyable, you get to explore and know the world in ways that you never knew. And you get to hear the voices of other people, whether it's through my book or someone else's book, it doesn't matter, but you have to enjoy that.
God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Muy buenas noches y bienvenido a Los Ángeles, doctor.
Gracias, muy amable.
It's a wonderful thing to see so many Latinos for the first time. I've been coming to these events for many years, and I think you really are a miracle maker.
Thank you.
I teach political science and Chicano literature in the Los Angeles Community College District. And I've been fascinated by looking at my students that come from Mexico when they're already mature young people and how well they do. Do you attribute your education in Mexico as having had a positive effect on your education here in the United States?
No question about it. I mean, if you look at my own family, obviously, the older children, we have taken advantage of the resources and the opportunities given here in the United States, even though we came from humble backgrounds. And when I came to the United States and my parents came too, I told them that we had an opportunity for my younger siblings, you know, who were at the time about 9 and 11. And it's quite interesting that even in my own family, they ended up being the two that somehow ended up getting sucked into the system. Now, remember, We landed in Stockton, that in 1988, Stockton, California, was the most violent city, according to 2020. There was a big documentary, because there was a clash of African-American, Latinos, and Southeast Asians that came all together at the same time, and there were killings all over the place. And somehow, my younger siblings ended up getting sucked in into this system. So my younger brother ended up not getting an education. My younger sister ended up being pregnant by the age of 16. So we are not immune. And my parents, they did the same thing. They raised us here the same way that they raised us in Mexico. But now that I look back, it took me many years to realize that it was a mistake. The ways that you raise someone in a different country don't necessarily apply to the ways of raising our children in the United States. And I can only speak from my own experience and my own parents. And now we talked about these things. But it is quite interesting, no question, that your experience in other parts of the world influence the way you develop in this country. Now, I've been very blessed that I had a lot of opportunities, obviously. And there's been an argument in the United States. People are critics of what I do. They said he should go back to Mexico. He took someone else's spot and so on and so forth. And there's an article somewhere in the internet of a mathematician that estimated that the chances of someone like me, even without education, becoming a brain surgeon are 1 in 40 million. All right, I don't know how they do this, all right? But they do. They're missing the point. I'm not saying that everybody needs to be a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon. We need good teachers. We need good plumbers. We need good farm workers. We need good welders. You know the two jobs that are the most needed right now, despite of the fact, the two openings and the two fields, despite of the fact that we have an incredible high unemployment, is farm labor and welding. So I have job security, just in case your brain surgery doesn't work.
Dr. Q. All right, Dr. Q, Kalimán is proud of you.
Yes.
So let's, you know, the great thing I like about Kalimán, they always has a thought. So I'll share the thought with you.
Thank you.
La paciencia es una virtud que debe ejercitarse continuamente. Patience is a virtue that you must continuously use, exercise. Yes. So thank you very much for
thank
being
you for
with
having
us.
Me. Thank you, guys.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.